All right, good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, May 29th. Happy Memorial Day. A little hot and muggy in the Lower East Side, but we'll try to get through it. Today's topic is Rav Moshe Feinstein versus conservative conversions in our Politics of Exclusion series. So even before we start handing out the sheets, based on what we've seen in the past couple of weeks, what do you think Rav Moshe Feinstein would say about conservative conversions? Just off of the top of your head.
Conservative conversion, you mean from being a goy to being a conservative Jew?
Yes.
I already
heard. Or alternatively, and it's an interesting way that you phrase that, but let's say a conservative rabbi officiating a conversion to Judaism. Because there's no formal conversion to go, like if you were affiliated Reform and then you go conservative or then you go Orthodox, there's no official ceremony. So you're talking about going from
non-Jew.
So you are talking about going from a non-Jew to Judaism. Now you phrase it very well. Is it going from a non-Jew to a specific conservative Jew versus a non-Jew to Judaism via conservative rabbi?
Well, I have been influenced by the MTJ students of Moshe Feinstein, and they had this attitude that it doesn't even count if you go to conservative rabbi. If you get converted by him, it's like you're still a goy.
Okay. So,
Well, I don't know. I keep looking for a wrinkle. I would say I'm 65-35. 65, I would agree with Ed. The 35, I'm holding back because of what happened last week. In last week's example, he was trying to find a way to be kind to people.
In a weird way, yes. In that, because we were talking about weddings, by invalidating a conservative or reform wedding, you actually made it easier for people to remarry because you didn't require them to have a get.
Right.
So now that's because of, say, certain ramifications. Off of the top of your head, what do you think would be some of the ramifications of the conversion?
Well, you're not it's not clear to him that you're accepting Torah Misinai.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question is about marrying.
Mm-hmm. There'll be a whole lot of other things that come up with that, too. And
you don't have a passport for every denomination.
Yeah.
You get an Orthodox conversion, you're accepted by all three denominations.
No. Nowadays, if you have an Orthodox conversion, you might not even be accepted by the Orthodox. That is an unfortunate reality.
I don't know if you want to include this in your podcast, but another thing that occurred to me last night listening was, is Mamzerut actually observed today?
Is Mamzerut actually...
You talk about he did this partly to prevent Mamzerut.
So the short answer is yes. The practical answer is we try to avoid it when possible. Meaning if someone gets up and says, I'm a Mamzer, and admits, I'm a Mamzer, no one's going to marry the person, but people try to avoid situations of Mamzer, and there are discussions about how to avoid it, so it's really a yes or no.
Usually it's people accusing other people of being Mamzer.
Well, yes. With this, there was a joke about, I did not come up with this one, is that people were in a shul, and someone asked if there was a Kohen to get an Aliyah, and someone raised his hand, said, I'm not a Kohen, but I'm a Mamzer Tamid Chacham. So with Rav Moshe, to at least continue with some of the themes that we talked about, we're still continuing with the themes of, having a very strong aversion to conservative Judaism because of the threat it posed and because of how misleading it might have been to people, because unlike Reform, conservative Judaism, certainly at the time that he was writing, at least claimed to be traditional in the sense of still following halacha. But additionally, I don't know, if he introduced this idea, but he certainly held up a relatively new idea in modern Jewish thought, that the mere affiliation of being a conservative Jew was enough to invalidate you completely. And we're going to see these today. So, today we've got a couple of responses by Rav Moshe Feinstein, specifically on conservative conversions, which I thought were a little more interesting than his discussions on the Reform conversion. I should point out here that we're going to discuss a little bit of the laws of conversion itself, because you kind of have to. Just like last week we discussed about laws of weddings. For anyone who's interested, the most comprehensive book on the laws of conversion, I apologize for forgetting to bring it in, is called Halacha Conversion in Practice. Halacha in but by someone named Menachem Finkelstein, if I'm remembering correctly. It's a really big red book. It's about 750 some odd pages. And it is the most comprehensive book on the history of the laws of Geirut. The main requirements for a halachic conversion are, anyone want to take a guess at what they would be? All right.
The guy is awake. He's not being clubbed over the head to...
we're assuming that it's out of...
twisting his arm.
So we're assuming that it's in his free will, but that's actually one of the factors here. So one, you need to have kabbalat ol mitzvot. You need to have acceptance of the mitzvot. And, you know, for anyone, for the things that I'm discussing, you're going to have extensive debates as to what does it mean, acceptance of mitzvot? Does it mean everything in particular? Does it mean general theory? We'll see if Moshe discusses. But one is you have to have acceptance of mitzvot. For men, you need to have a brit milah l'shem giyur. You need to have a circumcision that was done for the purposes of becoming Jewish, which meant if you have a if a non-Jew is circumcised when they were born, because it's a fairly common medical procedure, you don't have to have a second one, because once you cut off the foreskin, it's gone. But you have what's called hatafat dam brit. You need to have some blood drawn that could be done just very easily. Mm-hmm. You also have to have tivilat in the mikvah. You have to immerse yourself in the mikvah. And it has to be done, or at least kabbalat mitzvot in the mikvah, and ostensibly the brit, or at least hatafat dam, in front of a kosher beit din, in front of a kosher court, which would be, I mean, even that's a matter of dispute these days, but for lack of a better term, let's say three rabbis who know what they're doing and are committed to halacha, or whatever, redefine the most general term. So those are the main requirements you need to have for a conversion, without which your conversion is going to be invalid.
Now, I'm going to ask the guy, do you accept all the mitzvot? And he'll say yes, but chances are he doesn't know what the hell you're talking about.
So we're actually going to discuss that. Yeah. And according to Rambam, basically, when you ask miktzat kalot, miktzat hamurot, it's not so much exhaustive, but rather you ask some of the stringent ones, some of the lenient ones. Rambam writes about this in Hilchot, I believe, Yisurei Bia, forgetting the chapter offhand, but we can look it up in a bit.
There's two aspects, it seems to me. One might be simply a declaration that I accept all the mitzvot of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
But the other is there's kind of an oral quiz.
Yeah, and different people, it's sort of evolved in terms of what are the things that you're supposed to ask and how much and what are the things that you ask about. For example, Rambam says that you ask and inquire a great deal about matters of theology, probably more than was necessarily mandated by the Gemara. But, you know, the laws of conversion and the evolution of conversion have a whole separate class on it that would take about 2 hours in its own right. But, you know, we need just at least have kabbalat mitzvot, accepting mitzvot, brit milah, tefillah in a mikvah, and a kosher beit din. Those are the things that you need to know for the basic laws of Geirut to understand today's class.
One more cynical observation from me. A guy wants to be converted to Judaism. They ask him, do you accept the mitzvot? He really doesn't. But he says, of course. What's he going to do? Screw up the whole thing and admit that he doesn't?
So we'll actually talk about that a little bit later in terms of, you know, where such issues come up.
Yeah.
So, could you please start us off with Igrot Moshe? This is Yeridaya 160. Go ahead.
Regarding the conversion done by the conservative rabbi, should be in quotes. Rabbi conservative.
No. Well, first read the introductory line.
He wrote
regarding burying a non-kosher convert in a Jewish cemetery. Sorry.
Yeah. So right off the bat, so this puts it in some sort of context in addition to the ramifications of, well, if this person if someone was converted conservative, can you bury him in a Jewish cemetery? Right? So, and the date?
1950.
April 18, 1950. So chronologically, this is actually the earliest responsa that we're going to discuss today, but I also included it first because he really elaborates on the general the general problems with conservative rabbis. And yes, I actually probably should put that in quotes again because he does alternate from time to time in some of the tshuvot here. But anyway, go ahead.
All right. Regarding the conversion done by the conservative rabbi which lacked the proper acceptance of the commandments and the immersion in the mikveh was not done in front of a court, but rather in front of their women. Here it is clear that this conversion is nothing for the lack of accepting the commandments. And even if he accepted all the laws of the Torah except for one thing, it is invalid, as we find in Berachot 30.
Yes, you all put down Berachot 30. I mean, there's a Talmudic reference. If you're talking about someone who comes to Judaism, and they say right off the bat, I accept all of Judaism or all the mitzvot except for one thing, and say, let's say it's shatness, you know, something random there, of linen and wool together, right? You know, you could say, well, it's kind of trivial, but if someone approaches you and says, I accept everything except this one thing, is an invalid acceptance of mitzvot. Right? So he's saying right off the bat that a conservative conversion is worthless for two main reasons. One, there's a problem with the acceptance of the mitzvot. And two, there isn't a kosher Beit Din. There isn't a kosher court. Continue.
And also there needs to be the acceptance of the commandments in front of three. Otherwise it is invalid even after the fact, as found in Shach Yeridea 268.
Shach, a commentary on the Yeridea. So even afterwards, it's you don't even have, as he calls it here, Me'akev Afilu Bidi Avad, meaning it, sometimes you can have a distinction of Lechatchila Bidi Avad, otherwise known as Bidi Eved in Yeshivish. Lechatchila, was it A? There's some Latin terms that I keep forgetting.
A priori and a
posteriori, which are meaningless. Lechatchila means when you set out to do something, thing, meaning from the outset, here is how you act. The diavad is Aramaic that means once it already has been done, which means if it is the diavad kosher, it's like when you actually do something, this is what you're supposed to do. But if you did it another way, you still met the minimal halachic requirements. What Rav Moshe Feinstein says it's ma'akev de oraita, afilu b'diavad, then it means it's nothing even after the fact, meaning it's not that, oh, we're just being strict here and there's a general policy of how it ought to be done. It's like, no, there's absolutely nothing substantive in this conversion at all.
And therefore, there is to doubt the conversions, for there are rabbis who accept through Anan Sahade that the majority do not accept the commandments, for the end proves.
Anan Sahade, right. So, that the end result proves what was said earlier, and I put in parentheses here an explanation of what that means.
Okay, that is lack of observance after conversion demonstrates the lack of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And also that she would not be better than the husband for whom she converted, who himself violates Shabbat and abandons many prohibitions.
So this is a separate, it's almost like information not entered in evidence. Let's break this down to two points here. The argument, as I understand this, is that if someone converts to Judaism and doesn't keep any mitzvot, then you can sort of retroactively judge the initial intention by what they do afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the fact that they're, someone converts and doesn't keep Shabbos, well, then that sort of goes back to what they thought at the time of, well, maybe they just never intended to accept it. Right? That's point one in this statement. And the second statement is, let's say you have a scenario where a woman converts to marry someone, but the person she's marrying is a conservative Jew who, say, isn't Sabbath observant. So are you going to tell me that when she converts, she's going to be more observant than the husband for whom she's marrying? Now, truth be told, there are
cases like that. My sister knows a woman that comes on more strong about the Torah than her Jewish husband.
She's
a convert.
Well, certainly I don't know what things were like in the Orthodox world in the conservative world in the 1950s. 1950 itself, actually, not just the 50s. But I know in the Orthodox world, I mean, I've seen it too, where someone converted for marriage and took it more seriously than the spouse. And I don't think that the one reason why I don't think that's uncommon is when you convert to Judaism, you have to approach it from a completely different perspective than if you were born and raised. And if you're born and raised a Jewish, and I think it's one of the banes of Orthodox Judaism, you do things out of habit. You don't really think about things. But if you are, say, a Baal Teshuvah, someone who becomes newly observant, and certainly if you're a convert, you're approaching it from square one.
It's a formal situation.
It's more than just a formal situation. You are more proactive in terms of making that conscious.
Reaching for it.
You are reaching for it, which means you are accepting, coming at it from such a different direction. And you, the acquisition that you make on it is going to be a lot more personal than just, you know, you keep Shabbos because this is what you do every week. All right, continue.
I don't know if you want to take the time to explain what the Anan Sahadeh is.
So the Anan Sahadeh thing is more an issue of you can sort of gauge by what it is that you see. It came up, for example, in weddings,
yeah.
Where if you're in the back of even if you don't actually see the transaction of, you know, the ring being turned over, you can kind of see what's going on. Right, so, and it's, there's sort of like this assumption of, well, you know, we're a certain degree of an assumption, I suppose, of we're going to, you know, just by observance, you know, we can tell, like, here's what's happening.
Does the phrase literally mean someone sees? Someone witnesses?
More of like someone witnesses, so like we are the witnesses.
Right, okay. Oh, that's right. Still, there is room to say that this is a good conversion after the fact. After she tells the court that she accepted the commandments and it took place genuinely.
So he's already throwing in a monkey wrench here that, wait, maybe even after all that, there could be a theoretical possibility that it's still good.
Therefore, perhaps we can judge her even here that if she is not observant, then she really did not accept the commandments at the time of her conversion internally, only those with which she agreed.
He'll explain this a little bit later, what this means.
Even so, according to my opinion, we do not reason for these minority cases to dispense with what we have seen and to consider internal matters, but perhaps there is reason to consider.
So, I know rhetorically he is going back and forth. This isn't just a bad translation on my part. It's like, maybe this, maybe this, maybe this, maybe this. Ashok, please take the next paragraph.
And furthermore, it is plausible to say a reason for her lack of observance is that the husband for whom she converted violates Shabbat. She may reason that perhaps it is not such an obligation to actually keep the commandments, in which case she is as if she is like someone who converted among the non-Jews, as explained in
B Shabbat 68. So it's Talmud B stands for Babylonian Talmud. Shabbat is the tractate, 68 is the page.
All right. In Bavli Shabbat 68, that he is a convert even if he worships idolatry.
See citation, right, Ayin Sham.
And the reason is that he accepted on him to be like all the other Jews, even though he did not know any of the commandments at all. This does not invalidate the conversion. Rather, only if he knew and did not want to accept the commandments is the conversion invalid, for we do not require someone to study the entire Torah before converting only part of it.
So there's a theoretical possibility. It's a very, I mean, today it seems like a very strange gemara, that there is a theoretical possibility, and mentioned by Tosafot, you could have someone who is a halakhically valid convert who knows absolutely nothing about Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
And that possibility, today it seems kind of, you know, how could you have a convert who doesn't know about Shabbat? Back in the day it could have been, because if they saw that, well, this is what Jews do, right? Well, then it must be, you know, I'm going to do whatever it is that they do. And it's not an issue that they didn't accept the mitzvot. It's not an intrinsic flaw if they were ignorant of something. It's only a problem if they knew of something and they stated outright, we know what, that if you say outright, we know this is what the Torah says and we're not going to accept it, as opposed to being ignorant of something, right? Because he says, look, when we teach someone to keep Torah, look, very few Jews know the entire Torah, right? Orthodox Jews, people who go to yeshiva know the entire Torah. The Torah is really big. There's certainly, even if you don't want to talk about, you know, studying all of Rambam, even just doing Shulchan Aruch, there are a whole lot of laws involved.
Imagine, you know, the guy wants to be converted to Judaism. The rabbi's asking, do you accept the Torah? He says, hey, I don't know what I'm getting myself into. I didn't read the thing.
Which is why Rambam says, you ask him like some of the strict ones, some of the lenient laws, right? But you don't just, so it could very well be, and he's offering a theoretical argument that even if that perhaps, right? Even though you might say, well, she's not observant, and therefore that retroactively exposes a flaw in her acceptance of mitzvot, you may be able to say, you know what? Maybe she just had a cultural vision of Judaism that was incorrect, but there wasn't an actual flaw in accepting the mitzvot. She accepted the mitzvot based on the understanding that she had.
I was thinking of Ruth.
Okay, explain.
Well, I assume conversion is somehow based on Ruth, who just said, your people are my people. Where you go, I'll go. Where you buried, I'll be buried.
There you go. Yeah. Continue.
Okay. Therefore, even if the Beit Din told her that she needs to keep Shabbat, she may think that this is only a, quote, nice thing, unquote, to do. And even someone who does not keep Shabbat, etc., may err saying that he is a kosher Jew. We find that, according to this mistake, she accepted all of the commandments for which the Jews are obligated, even though, because of this mistake, she will not keep them. And this is a legitimate reason to consider her conversion valid. And this is giving the benefit of the doubt to the rabbis who accepted her in that they were not worse than... in that they are not worse than commoners?
Yes. So, when I explained here in terms of Hedyotot, that here he actually says, Ksat al harabanim, and he actually uses the term rabbanim, in that the rabbis who would do this officiating, he actually uses the term rabbis, like, well, maybe the people who are doing the officiating are no worse than just three random people. There is no halacha. We said, when I said that you need to have a Beit Din to oversee a conversion, there is no law that the people who oversee the Beit Din have to be rabbis.
Could be three clowns.
Well, hopefully they're not three clowns, but, you know, all it says at least they would have to be what we call, say, kosher Jews. I mean, let's say, observant Jews. And he'll actually explain a little bit in terms of Bikim, in terms of expertise. But there's no intrinsic requirement for rabbis. Because if Chazal said, well, you actually had to be ordained rabbis, then you would have to go back on the ordination of the time of the Sanhedrin, which we haven't had in a really, really long time. Yeah.
Oh, no. I just want to check. They had to be kosher witnesses.
Yeah, meaning they would have, and we'll see him explain this a little bit more. But certainly you could say, well, they wouldn't be, you know, would we treat the rabbis as any worse than just plain old commoners? Which is an interesting statement to make regarding conservative Jews, which he's going to sort of reject in the next paragraph. Because he had Moshe Feinstein, which we saw in the previous lectures, had a lot more tolerance for conservative Jews as, well, okay, they're mistaken and we're going to treat them kindly, but for the conservative rabbis, he had absolutely zero respect for it. Because a conservative Jew can just be misinformed, but a conservative rabbi is actively misleading the Jewish people. According to Rav Moshe. Throwing that disclaimer again.
According to him, is a typical conservative Jew a kosher witness?
We'll see explicitly his thoughts on that.
A conservative rabbi is not a kosher.
Well, continue with that. I'd take the next paragraph, but in any event?
But in any event, she needs to have accepted the commandments in front of a Beit Din and the conservative rabbis.
So here he goes back. Even though he ended the previous paragraph with the term rabbanim, in this next paragraph he again calls them, quote, conservative rabbis, with a transliteration.
Simply do not make one, for they do not know the laws of conversion. And they are not careful to accept converts in accordance with the law, even if they did know. And in any event, they lack the acceptance of the commandments, which does invalidate the conversion.
So right off the bat, he's saying, like, no, they're just completely ineligible because, one, they're ignorant. Two, even if they did know, they're not careful in terms of actually vetting the converts. Right? Continue.
And also the conservative Beit Din are invalid to serve on a court, for they are deniers for many of the fundamental principles of law, and they violate many prohibitions of kosher.
Violate many prohibitions. That should be a definition there. See kosher mishpat, right? So additionally, in addition to them being, let's say, occupationally incompetent, which is the best way that I could summarize Rav Moshe's statement here. Okay, I'll pass that down. We're on paragraph on page middle of the paragraph on page 2. But he's also saying that in addition, that they are personally, there's a personal flaw with them to even serve on a court, in that they reject the law and they violate many prohibitions in Sichosh and Mishpat. Continue.
It's like taking a KGB agent and putting him into the CIA. It's like, forget about it.
I will,
out of the question. Get rid of this bunk.
Finish the statement.
And see the Pitkei Tshuva in the name of Rabbi Akiva Eger, who says that even for rabbinic sin, one is invalid to serve as a judge.
Yeah.
And this does not need a formal announcement.
Right, meaning in terms of a formal proclamation. So for a little bit of context here, let me look up Choshen Mishpat 7-9. And it says here, reading from the Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat 7-9, Kol Psulim Lehaid, in parentheses, who's ever invalid to give testimony, Machmat Korvah, because of... relation, meaning there's a
being a relative.
Thank you, being a relative. O machmat avira, or because of a sin, pesulim ladun, are invalid to operate as a judge. That's Shulchan Aruch. The Pitchei Tshuva is a commentary below, cites Rabbi Yekiva Aker. Says here, "Im nitzachad mehem karvu pasul kulam pesulim." Sorry, that's the wrong. Sorry, first one, Machmad Avera. It says here, "Degam the Avera d'Rabbanan," that even regarding a rabbinic prohibition, lo ba'e hachraza. So that is a fairly, big statement that he's relying on here. That if you're going to say that even violating a rabbinic commandment invalidates you from serving as a judge. Now, that's a, if you want to say that they're, sinners in their own right. First he says that they're deniers of the Torah and they don't keep it. And then he says, sort of applies a fairly strict law about that, based on Rabbi Akiva Eger, that it doesn't apply to certain sins that invalidate you for Pesuli Edut, that we can't really get into here. There's a certain category of things that invalidate you and certain things that are specifically rabbinic. But according to, as I understand the citation here, is that even if you violate a rabbinic law, then you are invalid for serving on a court. Now, you asked about inconsistencies. Right? Here's where it comes up, because there are quite a few rabbinic decrees, that many of which we've discussed here, that standard Ashkenazi practice ignores. And they will say, well, we have our tradition or we have our understanding, this rabbinic law doesn't apply anymore, etc., etc., etc. So, it's kind of interesting in that case that if you actually apply this criteria of the Pitchei Tshuva to your typical, to pretty much any rabbi, or at least certainly Ashkenazi rabbis, they would pretty much all fail. Because I could point out at least a rabbinic law, and to just give two examples, anyone who dances on Simchas Torah violates a rabbinic prohibition against dancing on Yom Tov. Right, that's kind of, and the reason why people do it is based on a rationale of the Tosafot. But unless you have a court that's greater in number and greater in wisdom, you have no halachic right to overturn a takanat chazal. Or additionally, anybody who says halal with a bracha on Rosh Chodesh is technically violating rabbinic law, as we discussed in the Gemara in Aruch in Daf Yud. Says there are certain days you're not supposed to say halal. And what are you doing saying Asher Kedishanu b'mitzvotav etzivanu, thanking God for doing a mitzvah when there is no mitzvah? In which case, saying a bracha levatal as well. So yeah, it's a pretty broad statement to make that people would say justify in the Orthodox world, well, here's why, even though we might be going against the Gemara, it's still okay. I was having a discussion with Dr. Boyarin this past Shabbat about, one class where they're learning the Gemara and says, well, what's the halacha? The implication being that halacha is independent of what the Gemara says. And there are apparently quite a few schools, certainly more in Ashkenazi thought than in the Sephardi tradition, that believe as such. But if that's your criteria for who's going to be a valid judge, well then, pretty much they're all going to fail. So, anyway, continue.
And also, this person most assuredly violates many biblical commandments. And even if we do not have formal testimony, we could observe that whomever has the embarrassing name, quote, conservative, unquote, on them, under the assumption of having abandoned many prohibitions and to deny many of the fundamental principles. And I have already explained in one response that those who are established to be deniers are invalid for testimony, even without accepting formal testimony on them, even regarding someone lenient, and I do not have time to expand on this. Therefore, it is clear that a conversion done by a conservative rabbi is nothing. And I don't bother me because I don't have the time.
Yeah. And here is when, one of the statements that he has here, I'll read it in the Hebrew, where he really says this explicitly.
I like his temperamental outburst.
Shekol mimi sheshim habizui conservative alav hu becheskat mufkar lahabei yisurim. And I don't think this is the most explicit statement I think we've seen so far, where whoever has the name conservative attached to him, meaning by the mere affiliation of calling yourself conservative, is enough to consider that you're invalid. The very fact that you have this name attached to you. All right. And it continues with the rest here in terms of threw it in the end, but the effect is we'll skip this down, leave it just for edification, where he effectively states that you don't treat them as Jewish, and then he actually explains about burying Jews, burying non-Jews in a Jewish cemetery.
So
which,
a conservative Jew who got converted to conservative...
Actually, you know what? It makes sense to do this. You know what? What's it? Dr. Boyarin, take the next paragraph. Now, regarding if...
Now, regarding if one is obligated to engage in a great dispute, and after all this, it is possible that they will not listen to you regarding the cemetery, as they will argue as they wish, I say that since we do not bury the non-Jewish dead in a Jewish cemetery, as we find in Rashi, Yitin 61, because we do not bury the wicked by the righteous, as explained in the Quran, and we study in Beis Yosef, Yoreh Day 367.
Now, interestingly enough here, if you want to actually find a straight-up Isur Derabanan, a rabbinic prohibition against burying a non-Jew in a Jewish cemetery, you're not going to find that explicitly in the Gemara. I mean, the Gemara here discusses about burying someone who's righteous next to someone who's wicked. But in terms of having, a designated, quote, Jewish cemetery, you don't find, or I shouldn't say that. When I look this up, I have not found any source in the Gemara indicating such, of a special significance to a Jewish cemetery.
Because in their time, all the cemeteries were just Jewish.
But there was you still had distinctions about living, like you had Jewish neighborhoods, and there was distinction about Jewish neighborhoods, but there was nothing significant about a particular Jewish cemetery like down in the Gemara. So right off the bat, Rav Moshe Feinstein, you can argue, isn't relying technically on what you might call the Rabbanan, but also on certain interpretations came later. Medievals, continue.
Therefore, it is obligated only to watch for those who keep the Torah that were commanded not to bury them next to these converts.
You only have to be concerned for the people who are Shomrei Torah u'mitzvot not to be buried next to conservative converts.
If they're a few plots away.
And it is better to be strict to separate from them 8 amos.
Right. Now, why 8 amot?
Four.
Exactly. Normally, the a person, in terms of like personal space in halacha, is considered your own dalad amot, as an idiom of your own the 4 cubits that surround you. So when you have 8 amot, it's a actual distinction. It's the 4 from you and the 4 from someone else, right? So it's like they're in their own category. You're in your own category, not category. You're buried in your own territory. They're buried in their own territory, and you can say that you're not really overlapping with each other when you're 8 amot apart. I don't know in cemeteries what the normal distance is, but I know certain things like out in Wellwood, they're kind of packed in together where you don't actually have, you don't even have a 4 amot separation between graves at times. So, continue.
And for those who do not keep Torah and do not care, one only needs to protest for possibly by any account they are better than non-Jews for the purposes of burial. And one does not bury initially even a wicked Jew next to a non-Jew. And it is also possible that they repented 1 minute before death, and the death was an atonement for him.
Yeah.
By which he seems to vitiate statement of the wrong that he just cited above, that we do not bury the wicked by the...
He explains it a little bit better in the next sentence.
But there is no obligation to get into a public dispute on behalf of the sinners.
Right, meaning, you can say that you should protest, But don't make a big deal about it if you're trying to bury a non-Jewish convert next to a guy you sinned. Meaning, you know, maybe he did tshuva, maybe he was better.
So it would be better to keep him.
Right, so if you could, just like move it. But you know what? You don't have to get into a public fight over it. Yeah.
And for the keepers of Torah, is enough to separate from them 8 amos.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future, it is certainly better to convert them by a rabbi who knows the laws of conversion and does so according to the law. For there is still some doubt that they may in fact be Jews, as mentioned earlier, and it is best to keep them from those who are observant. Now, what is the course of action that he's suggesting here? Because it seems
finish the paragraph.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. Now, perhaps those who converted by a rabbi will reconvert a second time correctly.
Hmm.
And regarding those who converted not for the sake of heaven, and those who are lenient, come to judge based on matters of the heart, there's definitely what to suspect that they will return to their previous lives, and therefore even those who are lenient need to ensure that there is the acceptance of the commandments immediately before the immersion with the kosher base camp.
Yeah. So what do we learn from here? One, the same disdain that he had for, you know, conservatives regarding marriage, he has regarding conversions, or at least, you know, he did in 1950. Moving on to Igrot Moshe Yerideya 2:125. Yeah.
No, I still have a question. What in this sentence and in the future?
So it seems that his take, as I understand it, is the lechatchila. If you're going to convert people, do it right, and do it kahalacha. Right, the read the Hebrew Shul Shomrei Torah Laba Vaday Tov Shipol Shigayru Eitzel Rav Hayodia Beinyanei Geirut Beosek Kedin. That, you know, the way that should be acted properly is when someone goes for a conversion, don't do it in front of a conservative rabbi, but do it in front of a rabbi who knows what they're doing and will do it halachically. I mean, it's more of a general statement again on when someone converts, here's how it should be done.
It sounds like he's talking about people who have been through a conservative conversion and they're willing to, you should reconvert them.
Yeah.
Give them an Orthodox conversion.
Because he doesn't think that the conservative conversion is worthwhile at all.
And meanwhile, and keep them from those who are observant.
So
they can convert them properly. Mm.
I like his high-handed, melodramatic way of operating.
Well, I mean, again, any thoughts here? This was Moshe Feinstein in 1950. And in 1950, I mean, you still had, you know, large segments of conservative Judaism who would still be following halakha.
He's not saying that they're definitely not Jews. He said there's a suffix about it.
He threw it in there. No, but he actually said at the beginning that he ne pashut shegerut eina kalum, that it's worthless.
Well, that's not what he says later down here.
He offers a theoretical possibility that he happens to reject. The theoretical possibility that he said it might be valid is only regarding Kabbalat mitzvot. That he may be able to extend a generous view that even if they are not observant, that maybe that doesn't necessarily mean there was a flaw in the acceptance of the mitzvot, but the very fact that it was done by conservative rabbis, meaning the Beit Din was pasul, then that would, you know, invalidate it in its own right, which is somewhat consistent in this thought where he is going to give the benefit of the doubt more to the lay people than he is to the rabbis.
Right.
Right, because he finds that the rabbis are actively complicit in trying to destroy Judaism. He used the term last week, mechareku mekadefer, you know, actively rebelling and are misleading, you know, poor innocent Jews to an improper path in the name of Judaism.
How?
Yeah.
When did Feinstein die?
Was it 84, 86?
I remember it.
It was either 84, 85, 86, something like that.
Okay, so had to live with this disastrous development in Judaism for another 30 years after he wrote.
Yeah, and we'll actually see, it's important that you note that because we see some very interesting statements that he makes in the next 2 responses that came afterwards. Right, so the next one that we have is Igrot Moshe 2:125. How should mikveh administrators act when conservative Jews want to use the mikveh for their conversions? This is dated April 17th, 1962. So here's the situation. You got yourself a mikveh. Conservative rabbi wants to say, I want my conversions to be done here. Or I want to do a conversion here.
I'm going to guess that Moshe Feinstein says, if you do business with this guy, you're off our list. We're going to call you a mikveh puzzle.
Okay, so that's what you're going to put your money on. Let's go to the video drasha. Doesn't really work that way. And here, regarding the mikveh, which was constructed by workers for the sake of heaven, so that it would be easier for people to keep the laws of the mercy, and not, God forbid, an obstruction for the daughters of Israel who would need to travel far distances. And it creates a question as to how to proceed when a conservative rabbi, and here I put in Rav, Eich litnaheg kerotzeh Rav miha conservativin. Right? So remember I threw in the distinction here. There are sometimes he will use the term rabbis transliterated, and here he actually says Rav conservativin. Wishes to immerse a male or female convert, where it is almost certain that the conversion is not done according to Jewish law, but not to place them in terms of lahaniach, to place them there means to give them access to the mikvah, so as not to worry of creating conflict. And the issue of conflict is something that we already saw a little bit last week, and it's something that came up in 1950 in terms of to what extent are you actually going to make a big fight about this. Right? To what extent you're going to actually have a machloket over these principles with the conservative Jews. Right? So, behold, in actuality, all of the issues of conversions, even those performed by kosher rabbis, I'm not satisfied with them. And it is certain that all the sages will not be satisfied with them, for they convert for the purpose of marriage. So here it's an issue even beyond just conservative Jews, but with apparently conversion in general in 1962. And even though after the fact they are legitimate converts, this is only when they have accepted all the commandments. And I know many of those who, even if they accept the commandments, only do so to defraud the court. Right?
What I was bringing up before.
I told you, pretty good anticipating. Maybe they lie. And we should be C. Forgot that word, from the end of their actions, that they do not keep the commandments, meaning, like we said before, the fact that they are not fully observant after the conversion shows, according to Moshe, that when they accepted the mitzvot, they didn't really mean it.
But just to make clear, he's talking generally here.
Yeah.
Not just about conversions done by conservatives.
Absolutely. And he says, even by kosher rabbis. So he had an issue with what he saw being done in conversion, that it was not done in general to his standards based on even the kosher rabbis. Or even if they might have been halachically legitimate, he didn't like what was going on in 1962. Right? And certainly the conversions done by conservatives who do not check at all in these matters, and there are also many laws which they themselves do not keep, and they do not require from the converts that they themselves would keep. Now in this regard, I once had a question of someone who came to the shul who turned out, he came to the shul once on a Friday early, which was one indicator that there was something weird, and he said that he wasn't born Jewish, and this was his first time in an Orthodox synagogue, which let me include, he probably didn't have an Orthodox conversion. It turns out he said it was a Reconstructionist conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And with Reconstructionism, there is absolutely no question in my mind that the conversions are not halakhically valid. The reason being, the core doctrine of Reconstructionist Judaism is, to use Mordechai Kaplan's term, is Judaism as civilization. That you do these rituals not because there's a God who commanded it, or that you have any sort of religious obligation to do so, but rather this is what Jews do. Now, argue that maybe that's what all conservative Judaism did, and this was just conservative Judaism taken to the logical extreme, but at least if you designate yourself as Reconstructionism, one of the core tenets of Reconstructionism is sort of the denial of all mitzvot. So how could you have a conversion where you require people to accept mitzvot when your institution doesn't accept mitzvot? Unlike, say, conservative Judaism, even back then, would still at least, you could argue, whether or not they really believed it, but still talked about mitzvot and like doing these things, and it was still part of their core tenets of, keeping Torah. Reconstructionism got rid of it altogether. Yeah.
I have some question about that, because it was my impression that Reconstructionism changed in the 70s, that they sort of took in the whole New Age movement which may be more spiritual than Kaplan was.
Perhaps, but when the institution is defined by rejecting mitzvot, to say that you convert through this group that rejects mitzvot, and this isn't, you know, when I say that statement, I'm not using it in the same, using the same hyperbole as Rav Moshe Feinstein. I'm saying because this is what they've actually stated they believe or don't believe, for lack of a better term. But according to Rav Moshe, at least in this regard, you know, the conservative rabbis themselves don't keep the mitzvot, so how could you expect them to get other people to keep mitzvot? The logic would be similar, even though you may disagree with the facts on the ground in terms of are they shomrei mitzvot. But you could probably assume that someone who himself doesn't keep mitzvot isn't going to assume that other people are going to accept mitzvot. They're not going to. If you don't take mitzvot seriously, how can you expect or assume other people are going to take mitzvot seriously?
Whatever happened to that guy who walked in on Friday early in the afternoon?
Threw
him out?
No. It's a separate discussion that would take us off topic. We didn't throw him out. He was here. Continuing, and therefore, if a kosher rabbi would come to officiate the conversion, it is not appropriate for the mikvah administrators not to place him. Since the rabbi is a qualified teacher, is a moreh ha'ra'ah, it is not on the attendants to check after him. But for a conservative rabbi, there is certainly room to suspect that a conversion will not be done properly, for they accept converts without the acceptance of the commandments, and even regarding circumcision and immersion, these are not done without with a kosher basin. These are done without a kosher basin, and therefore it is proper not to place them to use the mikvah to perform their conversions. So even though Rav Moshe Feinstein might not be happy with what's going on in conversions in 1962, he would still say, well, if you have a kosher rabbi whom he considers a moreh hora'ah, you still let him do it because he's still going to get, you know, the basic halacha correctly. But for a conservative rabbi, you don't let him near it. Right? Or at least he says, you know, it is proper not to give them access to it. However, one must see that this is done in a manner so as not to cause dispute, i.e., meaning you don't want to have this policy actually create an argument within the community itself. So, how so? You can advise them to take an expert rabbi who can join with them two kosher people for the court, since it can be reasoned that they will not be so concerned if they are not... they are not considered experts, since from the kosher rabbis there are many who are not established experts and do not consider themselves experts, and hence will not object. Meaning one way you could get around the problem, again, this is him writing in 1962, 12 years after the what we saw in 1950, is he's offering a solution regarding the conversions, which is basically bring in ringers. Meaning if your problem is that the conservative rabbis are themselves invalid, so bring in kosher rabbis and say, well, we're going to bring in a couple of experts to oversee it. And in this regard, there are many pulpit rabbis, even today, who won't necessarily be experts, and to say, we'd like to bring in someone who, you know, let's say he's done a few hundred conversions, and they can oversee it because they have the experience. And if you have a rabbi who isn't so concerned with his ego, they're really, you know, they're going to realize, like, hey, you know, I might know certain areas. This is a specific area of Jewish law that I might not have expertise in. Sure, bring in some experts, because it'll help. And then if you're a real professional where your ego doesn't get involved, and we spoke about this yesterday in the park, to say, you know, we're going to bring in someone else who has more experience, your primary concern is going to be that everything is done correctly, not that someone is saying someone else knows it better than you. Because if you're really committed to halacha, it should be, yeah, okay, go ahead. You know, just have the backing.
Wouldn't you feel slighted if you're the rabbi in charge and they're going to bring in experts because they're not too sure about your
expertise? Next sentence. And if they do not accept this suggestion, because, I mean, let's face it, people aren't stupid either, and that they say that they are experts, then it is possible to distinguish between those who gave money towards the construction of the mikvah, where it is impossible to exclude them, and the mikvah intendants have no oversight over their actions. But for those who didn't support the building of the mikvah and cannot demand to be placed, then one should not give them access, because there's no concern of hatred or fighting, because they can say the mikvah is only for women, meaning for women to keep Tarat Mishpacha, to keep the laws of Nida, with the exception for those who constructed the building. So, first off, I mean, this is, I guess I'll throw it out here. How do people react to this teshuvah, especially in light of what he wrote 12 years earlier? Any thoughts?
But
go ahead. What do you, what's confusing?
I'm back on the bringing in the expert, so I don't know if
okay.
I get into
that. Yeah, that's what he said. Sure.
All right, so the expert would be who?
Orthodox rabbis.
But an Orthodox rabbi who's asked to officiate over the Tevila,
yeah,
would say, I don't believe that that you converted this person properly.
Or alternatively, by having the Orthodox rabbis who oversee the tefillah, and today, like when I've done conversions, you actually do the Kabbalat Mitzvah, the acceptance of Mitzvah, when the person is actually in the mikvah. And if they ask these questions, what he's effectively saying is, convert them l'halacha. Uh-huh. By bringing in the ringers, such that, yeah, you know, the way that you solve the problem of having conservative Jews do a conversion.
Back to court.
Exactly. But the end result is that the converts are halakhic converts, ostensibly.
And they make the presence of a conservative rabbi does not invalidate the conversion.
Ostensibly, yeah. And that even, and which is also phenomenal when you consider what he said about weddings last week, where the very fact that the conservative rabbi would invalidate two kosher witnesses, here it seems that the presence of a conservative rabbi and a beis din of kosher rabbis wouldn't invalidate the conversion.
This is yeah. like a union saying you have to have guys that are union in there, or guys as feather bedding in a sense.
But if the concern, but here the concern is to make sure that it's done correctly.
Yeah,
whereas allegedly. By weddings, having the conservative rabbi present, even if they're kosher people, there was enough to invalidate it. Here, bringing in other kosher, bringing in kosher people, just having him shut on the side.
Was that wedding sugar motivated by the question of Rabbanu?
It did come up. Yeah. But it's so funny that even if you want to say it was motivated by Agunot, he's still saying one thing in one place and another thing in another place, that if you put the two together, don't really seem to be 100% consistent. Which is part of why I call this class the politics of exclusion as opposed to the straight up halacha of exclusion. And we actually saw that with the Rav Moshe Feinstein on electricity a couple of years ago. You know, where it's not that he changed his mind, but on the response where he said why a microphone is prohibited on Shabbat, and the next Shabbat, immediately afterwards, back to back in Ingrid Moshe, why a hearing aid is okay, he gave mutually contradictory reasons. One reason why he said a microphone was problematic on Shabbat is because you may come to fix it. But one reason why he said a hearing aid is okay is because it doesn't always work. It requires its own class for that, but yes, you know, when you put those two together, it's like, wait a second, you just said in one place, but that, you know, it does, you know, when you talk about social policy, right, you can see why you would have a need to be inconsistent for issues of a wedding. You would actively want a wedding to be puzzle, if you thought that there would be minimal chance of a get afterwards, or you thought they wouldn't keep the laws of get, meaning you'd have a risk of mamzerim. Right? For the issues of conversions, I mean, here you've got, it turns out, your exigent need, which is fascinating enough, is a machloket in the community, which we've seen a couple of times, and at least at this period, he's actually concerned with disputes between Orthodox and Conservative. Now, Dan, take the final tshuva that we're going to discuss today. This is Ikrut Moshe Choshen Mishpat 224.
If it is possible to issue a mikveh decree or policy that even conservatives who give money for its establishment cannot use it for their conversions.
And the date?
January 11, 1977.
Right, so this is 15 years after the previous responsa. And here's
the thought to ask it in the meantime.
It's not, well, it's an interesting question that you raise here in terms of Rav Moshe Feinstein and the responses. He's reacting to questions that people have asked. Right, and whether or not he's dealt with this in some other shir within the 15 years, I honestly don't know. I'm not a Talmud of, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and you know, he being a brilliant man, probably said a great deal of shiurim in a scope of 15 years. This just happens to be a response that's dated in 1977 to which he's responding. And again, here's the case: is a takana v'mikvah. It's to actually set up a decree. I don't know how you. What was a better way of defining takana in this case? Whether or not you meant it was an official decree or just a set mikvah policy of just not to use it. Now consider the difference that you had in terms of. In terms of the one from before, where the conservatives were whatchamacallit, where the problem was you had people that donated money and a conservatory wanted to use it. So, you know, what he proposed back then was a certain degree of subterfuge, which was effectively you try to either get around the problem by bringing in kosher people, in which case you avoid the problem by actually having a kosher conversion, or you effectively say this is only for women, but not for conversions unless you actively put up the building, and otherwise you just say, well, we can't do anything about it. But let's say you could. Let's say there was a theoretical possibility where you could set up a takana not to use it. So here's what his answer is. In 1977, 15 years after the previous tshuva, 27 years after the first one that we saw today.
Here, regarding the mikveh which accepted money from a conservative congregation, and they wish to use it for their conversions, and you wish to issue a policy that they cannot do so, here it is not appropriate at all to enact such a policy. For most of the donors would not want it for this purpose, even if the policy was appropriate. But in actuality, I do not see here any policy to preclude allowing them to immerse converts not in accordance with Jewish law, for this is only an issue of placing a stumbling block before the blind. And since it is clear that because of this, it will not prevent them from accepting their converts, for there are many mikvahs in the surrounding neighborhoods, and they can even make their own mikveh, even if it isn't kosher, for they do not care about such things. There is no concern for lifnei iver, and not even a concern for actively assisting in their violation of Jewish law. Essentially, there is no purpose for such a policy. Specifically, there is a concern that they will make a mikveh not in accordance with Jewish law, which would obstruct or mislead their women, who would need a kosher mikveh. And thus, in my opinion, one should not make such a decree.
Huh. So despite that whole exclusion thing that he said before, saying do not make an outright policy to ban conservatives from doing conversions from their mikveh. And one of the reasons he gives is, well, there's nothing prohibiting, or not prohibiting, there's nothing precluding conservative people from making their own mikveh and making a puzzle mikveh, in which case you've now made more people not keep tarat to mishpacha. Now, think about just how, you know, what this response means. That in 1977, you might say that he softened up a bit, but also, what does it mean in terms of the implication? One of his concerns in banning conservatives from using a mikveh for conversions is that their women wouldn't keep tarat ha-mishpacha. The implication being is that they were keeping tarat ha-mishpacha, which is not considered one of the easiest laws that you're going to do. Right? So for all he says about conservative Jews not keeping law, not keeping halacha, there's still that acknowledgement
that they are.
That they really are. Right? So whether or not you can say he softened up or it's, you know, matter of hyperbole, he's giving an acknowledgement that you don't want to send their women to a non-kosher mikvah. But why are they going to a kosher mikvah if they don't care about halacha? You know, it's really fascinating when you sit and try to think about what did something change with conservative Judaism. Perhaps, Dr. Yaron.
I just have to object a little bit on the translation of the Lashon, which matters here.
Please do.
It doesn't say in the last sentence, making a mikvah not in accordance with Jewish law would obstruct or mislead their women.
Ah. Mm.
It says, "Gam noshim lichbol
bahem." Oh, I see.
So you got more mikvahs around.
Gotcha.
And
so I would.
Any woman might say, "Oh, there's a mikvah."
So I would. You're right. That is a great catch of a mistranslation on my part that I duly retract. We should take out the word "there." That refers to women in general.
It doesn't obviate the point, but it makes it not quite as sharp.
It does make it not quite as sharp, but I could also still argue that if the general assumption, why would women go to a conservative mikvah if they were just universally bad? Meaning, who are the women that might go to a conservative mikvah?
I mean, that's why I say it doesn't not be important.
Okay, fair enough.
Could the mikvah not have a label conservative on it?
Yeah.
If you knew that it was built or supported by a conservative congregation, I mean, also think about just how amazing it is that in the same statement, I mean, Rav Moshe Feinstein, along all of these lines, at least regarding mikveh going to a mikveh, saying that conservative Jews don't care about Jewish law, right? So, but there still is enough of a concern that they want to take the converts to mikvah. If they didn't care at all about Jewish law, why would they care about mikvah?
Yeah.
Right? Forget even, let's take it in the most general sense. Why would they be going to a mikvah? Why would conservative Jews build any mikvah? Even you want to say it wasn't the kashalu, even to specifically for their women that they're trying to protect. Why would a conservative synagogue build a mikvah if they didn't care about halacha at all?
For their converts.
Even for their converts. But, you know, having a mikvah is still something that's a religious requirement, is it not?
Well, it looks good to the outsiders, you know. You put up a mikvah, you don't believe in it, but it's the kind of public in general.
But through this whole thing, he's talking about conservative rabbis who bring a convert to an Orthodox mikvah.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it's clear that conservative rabbis need a mikvah for conversion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's true, in fact.
Yes, it is. But what it means is the vast generalities of denying, well, I mean, he doesn't say they deny all the Torah, they just deny large swaths of it, for lack of a better term, which incidentally, you know, because Rav Moshe Feinstein is writing a halachic responsa and not an academic piece, he doesn't really enter specifics in terms of, here's what conservative Jews have said, here's my source for what they said, and therefore here's where they break Jewish law, or, you know, so drastically. A lot of it is based on his own observational or anecdotal evidence, which, to be blunt, depending on where you were, even in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, your impression of conservative Judaism could have been drastically different depending on who was around you. So if the only conservative Jews that you see are the ones who try to, you know, basically do whatever it is that they want, that's going to be your impression. Whether or not, you know, yeah, but if you, the conservative Jews that you know see, apparently do everything else appropriately, you might have had a different viewpoint. But again, you know, he did say that once you have that label conservative, you are intrinsically invalid.
It would be interesting to draw a chart of his responses according to the growth of the conservative movement, because the 60s and 70s were high points in the conservative movement. There was a great growth, and it was the largest movement in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it only then started to decline. So he may have developed more knowledge of the conservative movement because there was more of it.
He was approaching senility because, let's say, he was
I'm not willing to say that he was, you know, senile, you know, at this point. But what I could say is that there's a certain degree of pragmatism that comes up, and that later he seems to be a little bit more concerned with machloket, with the arguments, in that we're saying that, I mean, you know, when we discussed the birth of conservative Judaism, we dated it to like the late 1800s. You know, we can argue about, you know, details of history, but, you know, you talked about, you know, the growth period in the 60s and 70s, which meant at the time it was more of a reality that you could not dismiss as easily. Whereas in the 50s, might have been easier to, say, draw those boundary lines, if I could borrow Dr. Daniel Bayern's term in terms of the Judeo, wonderful book on the Judeo-Christian, it's called Boundary Lines by Daniel Bayern. You know, whereas here, I realize, well, okay, you know, they're here. They're not going to go away. So we're not going to, you know, we're still going to treat them as distinct and maybe not halachic. But at the same time, you still have to deal with that in some level. Unlike, say, Reform in Germany, when you really had two complete distinct entities, there was, I think, a lot more overlap between conservative and Reform in the 60s and 70s. And you might have, conservative and Orthodox, where, you know, you might have had certain synagogues that might have been, to an outsider just walking in, indistinguishable from one from the next. And so there's a different issue. So you had a lot more intermingling. You know, the interdenominational stuff might not have been as extreme today. I mean, conservative Judaism today and what we call Orthodox Judaism today are drastically different. They both are. You know, we could argue one moved more to the right, one moved more to the left, and you've got a whole lot more gray in between, you know, this, well, whatever. Point is this. There does seem to be at least some transition in Rav Moshe Feinstein's thought in that the vitriol isn't there as much. He seems to recognize a certain degree of pragmatism, even though he still doesn't really respect conservative rabbis at all.
I would not take him as literally as you are, necessarily. In other words, this possibility that conservatives would obey the mikveh and want their own mikveh, that may be a theoretical argument that allows him to then be lenient.
It may be. I see. That they don't actually. Maybe.
It was that they might establish their own nickname.
You know, I don't know. I don't know because I wasn't around back then. I did hear one story by a student at JTS who said that at JTS they actually considered putting in a mikvah in JTS itself, like on the campus. And they decided against it because, as, again, this was as reported to me. I have no idea about historical accuracy. But the rationale was reported to me that they wanted to go to the Orthodox mikvahot to show the Orthodox that conservative Jews go to mikvah. And that if they just had their own mikvah, it just meant you were a lot more insular. By using more of the communal mikvah, meant you were as part of a larger Jewish community, and you were also able to show people that, hey, we're actually keeping lots of mikvah too. In which case, instead of just saying, well, we're right, we do what we say, we don't care, it's like, yeah, we're actually going to do this, and it'll be harder to argue against. So, I don't know. If anyone here has, you know, knows about conservative mikvahs in the 60s and 70s, it would be, yeah. I can't really answer that. So, next week, we're going to discuss the specific controversy regarding mechitzas in shuls, and in particular, we'll be discussing the opinions of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Soloveitchik, and an article written by my father on this particular matter. So, see you all next week.